Good afternoon, and welcome to School for Successful Ranching. My name is Craig Cowden, and I'll be moderating this session today. At this time, I would ask you to place all cell phones on silent and remove your hats. There's a table at the back of the room where you can place your hats. We would like to take this time to thank our generous sponsors for the School for Successful Ranching for their support for this program and commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the hallway on this floor, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo and say thank you. We couldn't do this program without them. Sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Dow AgriSciences, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Merck Animal Health, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, Bayer Microtechnologies, Diacero, Texas Range Minerals, Neogen GeneSeq, Rabo AgriFinance, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. If you're a new TSCRA member, we're holding a new member orientation tomorrow at 1 p.m. in room 101. We hope that you can come learn more about what TSCRA does for you and the cattle industry. Our next presentation is a popular topic called stocking rates, the same for everyone, presented by Stephen Dice and Calissa Garland from the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Thank you very much. In case you're confused, I'm Stephen and she's Calissa. Okay, so we can get that out of the way. So he mentioned the topic is stocking rates, the same for everyone? Well, the answer is no. Class dismissed. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to talk about some principles that we need to impart on you to help you make good stocking rate decisions. Now, it's something not terribly difficult. It's not rocket science, but it does involve some science and some math. So we're going to present some things that we feel are very important, and it's things that we do in the field. Now, I noticed in the catalog that this is listed as a beginner course, and so we designed it as such. I know there's a lot of you in this room that know a lot more about this than what this presentation will probably give you, but it's a good refresher to go over these things from time to time just to make sure that those principles are well understood. We understand it because we do this stuff quite a bit. We mix science and math to help y'all make decisions constantly. That's the biggest part of our job. So follow along, and we'll talk about some of these topics and hopefully help you to make good decisions on setting stocking rates. So the same for everyone. No, it's not. I mean, Texas is a big state. Like, the stocking rate is much different in El Paso than it is in Beaumont and up here and around Amarillo to McAllen, to even where I'm from around Victoria. It's very different across the state. And one of the things that I get questioned about from time to time in my work, I am a range management specialist. I have duties in about 20 to 25 counties. So it's a wide variance just in my local region. But I sometimes get the question, so what is the stocking rate for Matagorda County? There is no such animal. You cannot say that there is a stocking rate for a county, and there's not even a single stocking rate for your ranch, probably. If you split it up, this is the state in ecoregions. The odds are your ranch is going to have a lot of different ecological sites that are all, they're different based on the amounts, kinds, and proportions of vegetation that they're capable of producing in a given year. So even across your ranch, you can't say you have a set steady stocking rate on the whole place, because there's going to be some differences. You all know it. Y'all see it on your ranches. I see it when I come out. There's some places that are just more productive than others. So it's, you know, we can, all these different ecoregions in the state, if you just look at your place, you'd have a lot of differences that were probably more subtle than Trans-Pecos to the Piney Woods, for sure, but there's still differences there. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So one of the things that's probably the biggest thing that we talk about, and especially when we get too much or too little. This whole system is driven by rainfall. And that's variant throughout, you know, across years, within years. And this is my observation as someone who observes, okay, that I'm paid to observe in a lot of cases. I think it's more important the distribution of rainfall rather than the end of year total of rainfall. That distribution dictates a lot of how your vegetation shapes up. In our area, in 2009, we had a drought, okay? In 2010, we had what we thought was a great grass growing year, but it was a false economy because that grass all grew in the late summer because we had such a tremendous amount of summer rain in July. So everything is looking tall, and it's looking good, but underneath it, there was no foundation, okay? So these are the kind of things you have to be aware of. The whole system is driven by our precipitation. And, of course, after 2010, we all remember what happened in 11. So we were already behind the eight ball. We thought we had it good, and then 2011 came around, and we really didn't. We weren't prepared for that. And in a lot of cases, we were probably overstocked because I know all y'all think, well, I'm pessimistic. I'm very conservative and pessimistic, but I've met a lot of ranchers who say, you know, we're just one rain away from turning this thing around. So you got to be prepared a little bit for what comes in the future. And pardon our dichotomy on this, but we'll make it work.
In addition to rainfall, there are numerous other factors that affect your forage production. We're just going to touch on a couple here. One of those is the length of growing season. In Texas, most of the time, we're relying primarily on warm season forage. And so we need to know how many frost-free days do we have a year? How long is our growing season? Because that's going to affect our overall production. Obviously, if you're up in the panhandle, you're going to have a shorter growing season than somebody down in the valley. So you've got to take that into account. And then soils type. So just like Stephen was saying, there's different ecoregions and ecosites in the state. I can nearly guarantee that on your property, even if it's really small, you have several different soils types. And those have different characteristics. You might have sand, you might have clay, you might have a soil that is 6 inches deep to rock, or you might have one that's 60 inches deep to rock. And so all those things affect how much forage that soil can produce. And then in addition to the type of soil, also the health of the soil. And a lot of that goes back to previous land uses. Was it old cropland that they wore out, they planted cotton to year after year until they just couldn't anymore, and then they turned it back to grazing land? Or maybe it's been hayed for a lot of years, overgrazed. So those soils are going to be less healthy. They're going to have less biological activity, less organic matter, and they're not going to be able to produce as much forage as maybe that same soil type on the other side of the road that's always been managed well or has been managed well for a number of years and is in better condition. As we move through, we're going to define a few terms for you just to make sure we're all on the same page when we start talking about these. The first one here is stocking rate. This is just the number of a specific kind of animal utilizing a land unit for a defined amount of time. So 20 cows on pasture one for a year. Carrying capacity is the maximum stocking rate that is possible without inducing some type of long-term damage to the vegetation or other natural resources. So we're going to give you a little bit of background and then some ways that you can calculate appropriate stocking rates. And those will be expressed as acres per animal unit. So you might hear somebody say, you need 15 acres per animal unit. So that's what we're going to be looking at.
Okay, this is one of the concepts that a lot of people have issue with. And it's not necessarily that they totally ignore it. It's just that folks are not aware of it. Is the concept of grazable acres. There's a lot of things on your ranch that may cause if you have these things that might cause you to have a section of land but only be able to graze maybe 500 acres of it because 140 acres are covered with brush. There might be a long distance away from water sources. There might be a creek that cuts a corner off and the cattle just don't go back there. There might be an ecological site that just is not productive and they just don't go there. It might be something like steep slopes. You know, that's not a problem in my part of the world. Everything is pretty well flat. But I know there's a lot of places that have some steep slopes where cattle won't cross, either get up and use that area or go across to another area that they could otherwise utilize. So let's look at an example of the grazable acres. This is actually a ranch I work with in Victoria County. So we have this one field that's 392 acres, and this one that's 716 acres. So, you know, you might stock this at, I guess that's a little over 1,100 acres. So you might say, okay, so we came out and we measured the forage that's out in these open areas, and we can stock it at a rate of 12 acres per animal unit. So if you base that on that 1,100 acres, you're going to be wrong. In my part of the world, the biggest thief of grazable acres is brush. You know, we can grow a lot of stuff down on the coast, and not all of it is good. In this example, on that field one that has 392 acres, 374 of it are grazable. But in the one that's 716 acres, only 197 acres of that are grazable, about a quarter. So if you stock that at the density, at the stocking rate for the entire acres, cattle will overutilize those open areas, not utilize in that brush where nothing grows anyway, and you'd be overstocked. And then dry weather hits, and then things get worse. And then the condition just cascades downward. It's very important to grasp the understanding of the grazable acres. We have access to maps, and really the public does too anymore. With the Google Maps, I'd encourage you to take a look at those grazable acres. You can always go to a local NRCS field office and they can pull up maps and you can get assistance from us in that way as well. That's one of the capabilities we have, is these tools to be able to measure acres. And that's actually how I did this map. One of the ways we recapture those grazable acres in my part of the world is through practices such as brush management. That's another practice that we assist with. And that's really the purpose of brush management. The purpose of brush management is not to kill brush per se, but to try to capture grazable acres back that have been lost through encroachment. Okay, an animal unit. Okay, this is another terminology. You've probably heard of an animal unit, right? What that is one mature cow with a calf that weighs 1,000 pounds, and or the equivalent of that. So think about that, 1,000-pound cow with the calf. Does a cow have a calf all year long? No, not necessarily. But that's kind of the worst-case scenario. And when you're working with me and just our agency in general, we want to plan based on something that's not going to get you in a bind. We're going to be fairly conservative with our numbers that we give you. So we don't want you to have extra expense or cause you to buy a bunch of feed and stuff like that because of something that we recommended. So we're going to be a little conservative. We want to look at the worst case scenario. Plus, that gives you some buffer in the case of a drought like we have from period to period. So that's what an animal unit is. It's kind of hard to see that. But is that cow, would you say that's one animal unit? Who would say it's less than an animal unit? Who would say it's more than an animal unit? I'll tell you, that cow, just looking at her, I bet she weighs every bit of 1,400 pounds. So she's going to be more than an animal unit. So when you're doing your calculations, you're going to have to say that she's going to eat more than the 1,000-pound cow that we're talking about as being that baseline for animal unit. Okay? Are y'all understanding that? This is probably so far beneath what y'all already know. What about these ladies? Who would say that they're above an animal unit? Are they more than one animal unit, each one of them? Are they less? They're probably pretty close to right on. I would say those girls are probably somewhere between 850 and 1,000 pounds. So they're close to an animal unit. So probably the numbers would work out right for these. This is typically what you see in my part of the world. And I will tell you that most of the cattle on the Gulf Coast are going to weigh somewhere between 1,250 and 1,400 pounds. A lot of it depends on how much Brahma influence and how much hybrid vigor they express. But this is very typical of the situation that I work with.
Okay, what if we aren't just dealing with cows? Does anybody have anything besides cows? If you have cows, you probably at least have a bull, right? So bulls are going to be a little bit bigger, and so you would expect them to eat more. And so as you'll see, they're on this chart, 1.35 animal units. And this is, as the name suggests, an animal unit equivalence chart. A simple Google search will turn this up if you want to pull one up at home. Some of them have different species. But it lists some different cattle and then different livestock and tells you what their animal unit equivalent is. Just like Stephen was saying, a lot of our cows these days are actually more than one animal unit because they're not just 1,000 pounds. Same thing may be the case for your bull. It may be a little bit bigger, and so it may actually be 1.5 animal units. If you happen to have sheep, they're 0.2, or in other words, 5 sheep equal 1 cow. Goats are 0.15, so that's about 6, 6.5. And in addition to having these animal unit equivalents, this chart also tells you how many pounds of forage all these animals are eating in a day. So if we move back up here to our one animal unit, our cow with the calf, we see that she's eating 26 pounds of forage per day. And so that comes out to 9,490 pounds per year. Now, when we say 26 pounds of forage, that's air-dry forage. So if you go out and you clip green grass, it's got quite a bit of water content in it, right? So you've actually got to let it dry and then weigh it and come up with 26 pounds to have the equivalent of what she's actually eating. So what does it look like? This trash bag has 26 pounds of air-dry forage in it, okay? And that Stephen pulled from a field, and it was just a mix of tall grass and turf grass. And she's going to eat that every day of the year. She doesn't take off on holidays, Christmas, weekends. When you're running low on forage and you really don't feel like getting out there and feeding her, she's still eating that. She still needs that 26 pounds. Or if she's a little bit bigger, she needs a little bit more.
So, setting an initial stocking rate for cattle basically boils down to finding some kind of balance between this and that that is produced over this. And I selected that picture to show grazable acres. So, I'm going to put a plug in right now for my observations once again. From what I've seen in my area, the ranches that are managed the best, that always have grass, that don't have to feed a lot of hay, whose cows look really good pretty much all year long, they have some kind of rotational grazing strategy. that is involved in their ranch. Now, this doesn't come without some expense. You know, you can, there's water, basically, distribution, and fence involved. Fence and then water. You can have some really nice fence dividing your pastures. Or I've worked with clients that have one strand of filament wire. And I've had clients with one strand of just rusted high tensile wire that cattle respect. And they are able to rotate cattle and make them graze where they want to. And they are pinned in by that. So it doesn't have to be something elaborate and you know, basically hurricane-proof, because this ended up being hurricane-proof. This is right in the through the path of the hurricane. It looks like that now. But you can get by with something simpler. But if you're not rotating cattle in some kind of strategy to move animals around and give your vegetation some rest, I think you might be cheating yourself out of a little production. This is a ranch I work with in Goliad County, and this one actually has two different systems going on at the same time. There's one on the west side of the road, and that's a 112-day cycle. So basically, the strategy here is to have the cattle for 28 days and then move them here for 28 days, then move them here for 28 days, then move them here for 28 days, and then back to the origin. So they've got a 112-day cycle, okay? So that gives them 3 1/4 cycles per year. That's beneficial for a couple of reasons. One of the things that you don't want to do is end up having your pastures grazed at the same time every single year. Now, they're doing it just, you know, a 4-week period here, but this allows for a little bit of difference when they come back to that pasture. You know, it's not every July 1st through July 28th, this one gets grazed every single year. It's a little bit offset. So that helps bring in some diversity to the system. This is actually a rotational system that probably the best ranches that I work with utilize. It's not high intensity. I do have some folks that work with those types of strategies, and it works fine for them. But there's a little bit of a learning curve there, and they've got to be very careful with their stocking rate. The east side of the road, they have a strategy with a 105-day cycle. So they're getting about 3 1/2 cycles per year. So that's offset even a little bit more. And the strategy there is a 3-week grazing period. And for this one, the rest period here is going to be, oh gosh, right at 90 days. It's like 84 days. And the rest period over here is right at, oh gosh, well, 4 times 21, 84 days. So it's about the same amount of rest in either one. And, of course, water distribution in our part of the world is a factor, but it's probably not as big a factor. It's probably a bigger factor the further west you go, because when you have the bigger ranches with bigger pastures, then the distance from water has a big impact on how much of the pasture cattle utilize. They're going to utilize. They're just like us. They're a little bit lazy, and they feel very comfortable when they know where they're getting their water from. So they don't venture terribly far away from those water sources. So, speaking of water sources, this is another ranch I work with. And this one here has 10 pastures, and they rotate 2 herds, 5 pastures apart from one another. So there's a herd there and a herd there. So they're moved here. This one moves up. So they're kind of following each other around this track. This had been a high-intensity strategy with a lot of paddocks, and they went to this more extensive strategy because it just worked better for a lot of reasons, but for the lifestyle. And we're seeing a lot more bunch grasses on these systems as well. Bunch grasses like little blue stem, big blue stem, those types of grasses. One of the other things we deal with is the goals of the landowner. Both the ranches, all the ranches I've shown you so far, like their cattle, but they dang sure like their quail. So in order to have quail, you need those bunch grasses. So this is a grazing strategy that allows for that. Not to say others don't, but this is what's working for them. So you can see the water distribution. Everywhere where you see that symbol is a trough. This whole place is about 4,000 acres. So cattle do not have to go very far from water to get complete utilization across those fields. So this allows for more grazing distribution uniformity, I guess you could say, for lack of a better word, having multiple troughs in the field. It's easy to check also because he has a loop road all the way around the system. So that one is one of the ranches that I think is, if I was given the choice to pick a ranch that I could manage, I think I'd pick this one because it just sets up so nicely.
Okay, we've got a lot of good forage in this picture. And so the question is, do we want to graze all of it? We don't want to waste anything, right?
Contrary to what some folks.
Yeah, contrary to what some people believe, we don't want to graze all of it. We want to leave some. And so there's research that shows a direct correlation between the amount of leaf volume removed by grazing to basically the health of the roots, or on this table here, the percent of root growth stoppage. And then that correlates to your overall plant health. So if you'll notice, we can go up to 50%, remove up to 50% of the leaf volume, and we see a very negligible amount of root growth that actually stops. But what happens when we move from 50% down to 60%? All of a sudden, we lose 50% of our root growth. And then from there, it just continues to get worse. And so there's kind of a visualization over here on the right. As we remove the leaf matter above ground, once we get below that 50%, then our root system starts shrinking up. Why is that a big deal? Well, because those roots are reaching into the ground for moisture and nutrients that the plant needs to stay healthy. What happens during... Sure. Yes, it's going to recover as long as you don't want to, as soon as you figure out that you've accidentally removed too much, pull off and give it a chance to recover. If you continue to hammer it and there's long-term damage, you could eventually kill out those plants, especially if a drought or something like that comes along. The deal is you shrink up your root system to where it's just reaching maybe the top 2 or 3 or maybe even 4 or 5 inches of soil. And then we get in dry conditions. What dries out first in the soil profile? Those top few inches. And so that plant is suffering because it doesn't have the moisture versus the one over here on the... Oh, we may have died. Anyway, the one over on the left that has a deep root system, that one with the deeper root system is still reaching down. It's getting moisture. It's getting minerals. And so your plants are healthier. So this is where we get the rule of thumb, take half, leave half, okay? So we want to leave half the production out there, like we saw on that last slide, to maintain a healthy plant, a healthy root system. You've got above ground leaf, you know, converting sunlight, feeding the plant. You've got those healthy roots reaching down for moisture and nutrients. A lot of people, like I kind of joked about before, think that that's wasted forage if they don't graze it all and leave it out there. That it's a waste. But overall, your production in the long term is going to be higher if you have those healthier plants and leave a little bit now for insurance down the road and healthier plants down the road.
That is true. There's going to be grass leaves that they'll be able to graze down low. I have a lot of clients that feel like, well, let's take, for instance, little bluestem. It's a bunch grass. So it has its forage that they like to eat is down low. So when people see the seed head stalks come on and the plant has gone through a reproductive stage, they feel like, well, they're not eating it from the top down. So that's not a good thing. But the leaves that they like are down low. And the same with these other bunch grasses like the side oats you see in the slide. So, yeah, they're not going to eat it from the top down and they're not going to necessarily eat the seeds. They might accidentally get that, but just the way cows eat, they have to wrap their tongue around, pull, and that's how they get things ingested, okay? But when they have the forage down low that they can have access to, that's what they're eating. They're not going to start at the top and chew down. Does that make sense? I don't know that that's really that much of an issue, you know, because it's still going to have those leaves down low. And there's still going to be parts of that plant that, you know, it's its own food factory. So it's taking sunlight and converting it into something that cattle can utilize with the end product of something as food for us. So I think when you have green leaves on the plant, and even when you have dry, old senescent leaves, like this winter we had cool snaps in our part of the world, we had standing hay, and cattle were doing just fine on it. So they were eating. They're probably not going to eat the real stemmy stuff, or if they ingest some of that, they may not go back to that plant because that created a bad feeling for them. But they'll continue to utilize the fine material, and that's the part that's down low, usually on the plant, near the base. Does that make sense? I don't know that you would have to, though.
You know, towards the end of the growing season especially, you want them to go to seed to continue to reproduce and fill in any gaps in your system and replace any plants that die. So definitely at the end of the season, you want to let it go to seed and not mow it down right away. And so during the season, if you're doing a rotation and you can time it to keep stuff vegetative, that's definitely to your advantage. But you've got to evaluate the field as a whole and make sure that you're not overgrazing in an effort to keep everything vegetative. You're going to have some that are at a little bit different time frame, and some are going to seed and some aren't yet. So you kind of have to work out the timing that's best for the field as a whole.
You know, it'd be kind of a good time to talk a little bit about harvest efficiency right here.
Yes. You want me to or you want to?
Go ahead.
Okay. So we've got the rule of take half, leave half. So the most important part of that is we're leaving half out there for the health of the plants. Now, of the take half, some of that is going to actually be consumed by your cattle or your livestock, but some of that they're going to trample onto the ground, some of it's going to get eaten by insects, and so the cow isn't actually getting half of the production. What we do is take the half that we're taking, we divide that in half and say that half of it's going to get trampled, half of it's going to get eaten by insects, and then the cow's going to get half, or 25% of the overall. The 25% is our general rule of thumb for rangeland. On introduced pastures, you may work up to about 35% harvest efficiency, but when we go to doing math in a minute, you're going to see the term harvest efficiency, and that's what it's referring to, the percent of the overall production that the cow is actually consuming.
Okay, this is a scenario that's real life. I took this picture. There are 14 mama cows in this picture, and they're all about 1,250 pounds apiece. So every mama cow is going to eat about 33 pounds of forage per day on air dry basis. So they're really eating more than that, but on air dry basis, about 33 pounds a day. They're going to be in that pasture for 73 days that during the course of the growing season, and there are 47 grazable acres in this field. And the production looks to be about 3,000 pounds per acre this year. So now it's math time, okay? If you got a handout, this will help you out later on when you're thinking about it, because sometimes it's hard to remember these concepts, but hopefully this will stick a little bit, especially if you've got it in front of you. So we had 14 head eating 33 pounds a day for 73 days. So they're consuming 33,726 pounds of forage, okay? So the production side, we have 47 acres producing 3,000 pounds per acre. We have 141,000 pounds being produced on that site. So the 33,726 pounds consumed divided by the pounds produced gives us a harvest efficiency at right at 24%. So in that scenario, without even knowing it, that rancher is exactly on target as far as the range production goes, as far as the harvest efficiency for that particular situation.
You can just hold on to it. So is anybody more of a visual person and doesn't want to do all the math? It's okay to raise your hand. Yeah. So grazing exclosure, grazing cages, they go by a couple different names. These are a great option to get a visualization of how much total production there is and then how much has been grazed. There's no set design for these. Usually three or four T-posts and a couple cattle panels is what you'll see. So in this picture, there's four and one or two panels. Basically, you're just fencing off a small area that's representative of the field. You don't want to pick an area that produces real high or real low. But you're fencing it off to where the cattle or other livestock can't graze it. And so within that cage, then you can see what the field is actually producing, and you can compare that to the outside where you've been grazing. Probably the easiest way is to use a yardstick, and you can measure. We're going to talk about clipping in a minute. You could actually clip inside and outside to see what the pounds of production were for each. But just running out there with a yardstick and measuring, and you can say, okay, we're at about 50% use. Oh, we're at 70. You know, we need to pull off. Anyway, this is just a real easy visualization tool to use. So we're going to discuss three different methods of measuring forage. The first one is the wild guess method, trial and mostly error. Then we're going to talk about using a grazing stick. And then, like I just said, we're going to talk about clippings.
Okay, the wild guess method is pretty common in Texas. There's a lot of misconceptions about this. And I see, in my line of work, I see the best and I see the worst. Very seldom do I see just average. The worst are there for, I'm learning from the best. The worst are asking for help, so I try to impart to them what the best are doing in order to get their places in a little bit more reasonable condition. But it's fairly common, and the strategy pretty much to my observation is that they put a bunch of cows out there, wait until they eat everything and then start feeding, and then they sell only the calves if the cow happens to have them. So that is not a very good method, so we do not advocate this method of setting a stocking rate. A more reasonable method is the grazing stick method.
I'm going to let you hold on so I can. Is anybody here lucky enough to own a grazing stick? Okay, a few of you, good. So a grazing stick is kind of a glorified yardstick. So if you have one, don't be too disappointed. You can use a regular old yardstick. We had hoped to have these for everybody today, and my understanding is there's an order, but it's not here yet. So pull out your yardstick, and you can use those. What we're doing with the grazing stick is we're going to find a key grass, and we'll discuss what that is a little bit more detail in a minute. But basically, we're measuring the height of that key grass to decide when we need to stop grazing and rotate the cattle, and then when we can start grazing again. So if you have a grazing stick, there are several heights marked for different grasses. Different grasses have different grazing heights that you want to reach before you, or minimum grazing heights, and then heights that you need to get back up to before you start grazing again. I won't try and go through all those. If you don't know them, you can get with your local NRCS office, and they can work with you to figure out what kind of forage you have and then what those grazing heights are. So like I said, we're going to be grazing that forage till we get down to a minimum height. Then we're going to rotate the cattle, and then once it gets back up to a certain height, we can start grazing it again. Now, if you get through your rotation, maybe you're rotating through four fields, and you get ready, you started in field one, and you've gone through all four fields, and you get ready to graze field one again, and you go out there and measure your forage, and it isn't back up to that height that it's supposed to be before you start grazing again, that's a sign you've got too many cattle. So you either need to get rid of some cattle or find some more land.
Or buy feed.
Okay, so the key grass, like I said, that's what we're picking out to measure off of. It's going to be a grass that's fairly common in the field, and it is also one that is palatable, that the cattle like to eat. If you pick one that there's just one or two plants in the whole field, it's probably going to get grazed out pretty quick, and your rotation is going to be thrown off because you're going to be rotating quicker than you really need to be for the overall field. Unless you're really looking for an upward trend where you want to increase that particular grass that you're keying off of. And then, of course, if you pick one that the cattle don't like, you're going to go out there every day and measure it and say it's fine, and the rest of the field may be bare dirt at that point. Okay? So you got to pick one that they like, that it's fairly common. And then you want to measure it in an area that's receiving moderate use. You don't want to be measuring right beside your water source, right beside your mineral. Those are going to get heavier use. And you also don't want to go to the far corner of the field that the cattle can't even get to and measure the plant there. Because same thing, you're going to get overgrazed before that plant is ever touched. So in rangeland, examples are some of our typical or desirable range grasses, big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, side oats, blue grama. If you have a Bermuda pasture, it's going to be real easy to pick your key grass. Probably going to be Bermuda. Okay, so any questions on the key grass? And again, that's something that if you're not sure, you can definitely get with your local NRCS office, and they can help identify your grasses and then help you pick out a key grass. So just like we have our favorites, cattle have their favorites. He was talking about rotational grazing. If you don't rotate, if there's continuous grazing or heavy overgrazing, the cattle are going to go through and pick out all their favorites, the more desirable plants. And then in the long term, you're going to be left with a less desirable plant community.
Yep. If I have ribeye steaks and Brussels sprouts in my refrigerator, guess which one I'm going to eat first? Cattle are not very much different from us when it comes right down to it. Clipping. Okay, so this is one of Mr. Farley's students. I like to do clipping. I've been accused of spoiling clients I work with by doing a lot of clippings for them. I do have some ranchers that I work with that do their own clippings. And what that entails is just taking tools like this. See, I like to be efficient, so I use huge clippers. I do not use this. I used to use that, and that takes a lot of time, so I use these bigger ones. And I have a frame that's approximately 26 and a quarter inches by 26 and a quarter inches. I put that over, either at random or directed, over something that looks either average or it looks like it's in an array that I'm going to establish. And that's a whole nother lectureship series on that. But when I clip that, put it in a paper bag, allow it to dry in a climate-controlled area for maybe 4 or 5 days, and then I weigh it with a gram scale and end up logging that, and whatever I weigh in grams out of that 26 and a quarter by 26 and a quarter frame, I multiply that number by 20, and that gives me pounds per acre. So then I have a starting point to say, okay, I can go any direction at all. If I can figure out the grazable acres and that, then I can say, okay, I have this many cow days in this field compared to this many in this field, and design a system. And that's kind of how I do it on my job. Yes?
How low do you put your grams?
You know what? I'll show that. You are clairvoyant, because I'm fixing to show that. So here's my frame laying out there. Back when it was painted, I had it painted white so it would show up in a photograph better. And I clip it about like that. You know, we talked about harvest efficiency just a little while ago, so I clip it close. But you know, there's some of that, if you leave some, that's just building you in some drought buffer. That's a good question, but that half is sometimes hard to ascertain when you're in the middle of the growing season. You don't know where that plant will end up with. Neither do we know that necessarily when we're clipping everything at the base. But I like to clip it from the base, and then this is going to compound things for you. But then I kind of correct that based on where we are in the growing season. Like if I were to do a clipping now, and I just did one, a bunch of them the other day in Matagorda County, well, I've got a lot of growing season ahead of me. I don't know exactly what that's going to be, but I have a pretty good idea. So I can somewhat build in a correction based on the production we have on March 12th or whenever that was, projecting that out to the end of the growing season based on data that we have in our ecological site descriptions known as a growth curve. You know, you can, but you don't necessarily have to. You know, I think Charles probably talked about, or is going to talk about, the art of all this and putting it together. You knowing how to deal with the data that you have at hand that I, Calissa, Charles, or anybody else can get you is part of the art of managing your land. Okay, I have this information, and so I'm observing changes as we go along. How do I respond to those changes? Are they eating too much? Are we not getting any growth? We've quit getting rain, so now I'm, you know, having to deal with this other issue. I'm probably not going to grow as much as what Stephen Dice said I was going to grow. So now I've got another impact at hand. How do I respond?
I was just going to add on the clipping. It's a lot easier to go ahead and clip all of the forage, and so we get a number for total forage production. And then when we go to calculating the stocking rate, we take into account that we're not going to actually use all that. If you were to go to trying to clip half of it in the field, you're going to be doing a lot of guessing on whether or not you're actually getting half or not. So we go ahead and clip all of it and then factor in the take half, leave half a little bit later.
So that's what it looked like before. That's what it looked like after. That was 5,800 pounds. Now, I know that you're probably not going to rush out and go buy a bunch of gram scales, clippers, frames, and build frames and things of that nature. But I would encourage you to maybe ask some of us out and to do this for you. And over time, you'll develop an eye for, okay, on my place, 3,500 pounds per acre looks like this. And you can even photograph that beforehand and keep a log of that. Okay, so when Stephen Dice came out to my place, he clipped this frame, and before he clipped it, it looked like this, and he wound up with 4,200 pounds per acre. Then you have a reference. But I've done enough clippings where I can reasonably guess, but you know what? I still check myself every now and again just to make sure I'm calibrated correctly. Yes. I'm sorry. That's how many inches the frame is. That's manna from heaven. That's already been calculated out. No, it's all that is a simple weight per unit of area. So you're converting grams into pounds per acre.
Somebody smarter than us came up with that conversion number.
I've actually gone through the calculations and it does work, but I don't have time or the mental acuity to do it right now. Times 20 for that size of frame. Now, you can use a different size frame. Like, would the frame that I use on the Gulf Coast necessarily work for the Trans-Pecos? Maybe not. It wouldn't be as accurate. I think they would need a bigger frame out there because they have less vegetation. No, the frame size is immaterial to the calculation. The conversion factor is grams per that unit times 20 is pounds per acre.
I'm going to show you an example in just a minute using your yardstick or grazing stick. So that's something you have, and then I'll show you the conversion factor on it.
So here's the example. This might clear up your question. Okay, so we have 5,800 pounds per acre. And you know how many grams we clipped out of that? It would be 5,800 divided by 20. So whatever that is. I don't know, 290? Okay. So we had 290 grams. We weighed 290 grams out of that frame that looked like this. 290 times 20 is 5,800. Okay, so that's where that figure comes from. We don't do the multiplication by 26 and a quarter or anything like that. That's just an area. Okay, and we have 62 grazable acres. 5,800 pounds times 62 acres is 359,600 pounds. That's how many pounds of bulk forage, immaterial of take half, leave half, harvest efficiency, or anything else. That's what is out there. So take half, leave half brings us down to 179,800 pounds. Of this half, about half will be lost to bedding insects, hogs, defecation, urination, and so forth. So that half, again, is 89,900 pounds. A cow needs 9,490 pounds in a year. So that number divided by that, you can have 9.4 head out there. So find yourself at a sale barn. I'll need 0.4 of a head. But at any rate, round that down, not up.
And so in our world, that 359,000 pounds of
forage. Well, it depends on where you live. Like, you know, for us on the coast, we grow through October. So it might end, depending on where you're at, it might end in September. But that's what you have available. No, it's not. And that's why I've said at the first of the talk that distribution of rainfall is more important than the bulk rainfall that you get when you tally everything up at the end of the year. You know, everything's working against you. Nature is fickle.
Okay, stick with me through one more example and set of math equations. This is going to have similar math as Stephen's, but like I said, this is using either your grazing stick or a yardstick. So most of you aren't going to go out and buy frames for clipping, and you're probably not going to buy the little special gram scale. If you have just a simple kitchen scale at home that weighs in grams, you can use that, and it's going to get you close enough. So You can take one or two yardsticks and square off a plot like he was showing with this frame. You use them, square off that plot, clip the grass. We're clipping for all the forage again. You got to let it air dry. Okay, we can't weigh it when it's still got all that moisture in it. Let it dry for a day or two. How long it takes to dry is going to vary, some on the season and some.
Right. Well, in our humid part of the world, it takes a little while.
Yeah. But make sure it's all going to dry. You can weigh it one day and then come back and weigh it the next day to make sure that it's not still losing weight. And then once you get those grams for this size frame or clipping that you're squaring off, you're going to multiply it by 10.7 to get pounds per acre. Okay? So here's an example down at the bottom. We clipped and got 200 grams. Multiply that by 10.7, so we've got 2,140 pounds per acre. Okay, any questions on this part? Okay.
That's 1 square yard?
Yeah. Yep, just like I said, if you have two, it may make it a little bit easier to square it off, but you can use one. So what do we do next with these numbers? We're going to look at a couple different things. We're going to look at the total forage available, the forage available for grazing, which is the total forage times the harvest efficiency. Then we're going to figure acres per animal unit, and then the number of animal units that we can run. So for this example, we've got 2,140 pounds of total forage production. We talked about earlier that the animal demand for one animal unit for a year is 9,490 pounds. That's where that number is coming from. And then we're just going to say we have 400 grazable acres. So the first thing we're going to do is multiply our total forage by our harvest efficiency. So 2,140 by 25%. So per acre, we've got 535 pounds of forage that those cattle are actually consuming. So next, to get our stocking rate, our acres per animal unit, we're going to take the demand, that 9,490, and divide it by the 535 that we just got. So in this example, we need 18 acres per animal unit. Okay? Now we're saying that we have 400 acres that they can graze on. So how many animals do you go out and buy, or how many should you have? You're going to take the 400 and divide it by that 18, and that's 22 animal units. Okay? Now, what if you're buying 1,300-pound cows that are 1.3 animal units? You can take the 22 and divide by 1.3, and that's going to give you the adjusted number for that size cow or for that animal unit equivalent. Questions on this? This is probably going to be the most likely scenario. Like I said, are you going out with the yardstick or the grazing stick? Remember the 10.7. This is all in your booklet, and then you can follow through that math.
Okay, things to keep in mind. Now, we talked about a lot of things, and it was confusing for some of y'all. This whole thing works so much better as a field exercise. So if I'd encourage you to go to your NRCS office, or if you have a grazing specialist nearby, ask them out. If this is something you really want to know about, we're happy to help. We can come out and do this. I do this a lot. So don't feel overwhelmed and don't get aggravated with the procedure, because there is some help. And again, it does work better when you're actually able to see it for your place. So I'd encourage you to maintain an attitude of flexibility and shape your herd up that way. That way it's not so painful to get rid of animals, okay? It's easier to grow herd numbers from a conservative standpoint than to have to cull down from an aggressive strategy. Use some type of measurement, you know, whether it's just visual or, the grazing stick method, clipping, whatever, but it's important to have some kind of assessment or measurement to assess where you're coming from forage-wise every now and again, and make a plan for when drought hits. Already have in your mind who you're going to get rid of out of your herd when it comes time to reduce your animal numbers. That makes it a whole lot better too. Okay? And more important than any of that is the ranches that I work with that are doing an excellent job of grazing, they all keep very accurate records. They've asked me, I've had several ranches ask me to review their records on grazing, and we found some opportunities from that. They didn't realize they weren't grazing the buzzard pasture. They haven't grazed the buzzard pasture in 3 years. They keep those records, but there's sometimes you got to back away from the trees to be able to see the whole forest. So keeping records and notes is very important. This was a whirlwind hour or however long we've taken on this, and I know it's a lot of complex information. There's no way to really get down to a beginner level and introduce these concepts in an hour. If you'd like more information, we are at booth 1043 in the exhibit hall. You can visit with Calissa, will be there periodically, and I will as well. But we all sing the same song pretty much. This is something we all understand as range management individuals. So you're not going to spring any surprises on us from this anybody in the booth. But we'll be there from time to time as well. And I'd encourage you to seek out assistance from your local field office of NRCS when you have an opportunity or if you have more questions on this type of material. To close out, do y'all have any questions or final questions for us?
Did you say what the grazing efficiency was on computer grass?
You know, Calissa alluded to it. It's above 25%. You can do, on grasses like that, especially if they're fertilized or otherwise cultivated, I use anywhere from 33% to 40%. And a lot of that has to do with the grazing strategy of the individual rancher.
I heard 50 on a rotation. That's the reason I'm asking.
Well, yeah, that's leaving just very little margin for error because even Bermuda grass, as tough as it is, I'm sure it has its limits as well.
Are you asking how far they will travel from water?
I mean, it depends on
A lot of it depends on slope, terrain, how many impediments they have to and from water. I saw one study where the figure of 400 yards from a water source is where cattle will do about 70% of their grazing. Yes. I've not had any ranchers do that. They sort of just leave it, but that would be a very good idea in order to kind of put everything back to a set start. Because I've got some cages out there now. I was planning, the hurricane disrupted a lot of my work down there, but I went back and looked at some of those cages, and they've got a lot of old growth in them. So you're right. That would be good to freshen up within those cages or just move them around. Maybe move it off of that particular area onto something that is starting from the same spot as everything around it. Yes, sir. I think moving it would be just as good a strategy. Yeah.
Well, and definitely every year. Because when we're clipping, that's something else we may not have mentioned. We're finding annual production, so we want to be clipping this year's production. So if you go into a field that hasn't been grazed in several years and start clipping, you may have to kind of sort out what's from this year and what's old growth.
And here's another thing I've overlooked. If I may, just for 1 second. When I'm bagging up stuff, when I'm doing those bulk clippings, I don't put in things like ragweed or cider or anything that I don't feel like the cattle are going to utilize. So I don't want to bias it that way. Okay, yes, sir.
Have you ever worked with folks that
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And it's just a deferment period. You know, that'll depend on where you're at. Because in our part of the world, I've gone to look at places that had a prescribed burn run across them. And sometimes within 45 days or so, you know, that those grasses are ready to be grazed. But, you know, we probably had quite a bit of rain in there, or productive rain in that period between when the burn was conducted and when I went out there. So it's going to vary a lot. In our standard in specifications, we call for a 90-day deferral.
90-day
deferral. In other words, after a burn, give it 90 days to recover.
So when you do all your calculations and you say, okay, I got this much for forage, you know, after I take half and leave half, how do you visually know when you've reached that level of consumption?
One of the things is those cages, because you can see what's inside the cage and what's outside the cage and say, well, there's twice as much inside the cage as outside, so I'm about utilized about 50%.
Okay, we better wrap up questions as a group. We were told we were standing between y'all and happy hour, and we don't want to do
Ooh,
that.
Yeah.
But we'll stick around for a few minutes if anybody wants to come up
It'll
and
be
ask
sad
any
hour.
Questions.
Okay. Thank you all to the presenters. It's great information. That concludes the School for Successful Ranching today. Thank you for all attending. The expo is open until 6 p.m.